Hello and welcome to Showing Up with Good Culture. I'm Liz Matthews.
And I'm Jordan Mitchell. Showing Up is a podcast with purpose where we speak to the change makers who are positively contributing to culture to impact the world around them. In this episode, we're speaking to the wonderful Katie Piper.
Katie is a best-selling international author, inspirational speaker, TV presenter, and charity campaigner. She is the host of the award-winning podcast Extraordinary People, the founder of the Katie Piper Foundation, a BBC Radio 2 host and presenter on Songs of Praise.
She's also a passionate writer, which has seen her author over 10 books, which include autobiographies, children's books, daily affirmations and journals. Katie has also recently been awarded an OBE for her charity work. Well done.
Oh, thank you. Everyone keeps saying to me, oh, we'll call you Mom. I'm like, no, I think that's the Queen.
Well, Katie, thank you for joining us. I guess the term showing up means different things to different people. And we always start this podcast kind of asking our guests, what does showing up mean to you?
Yeah, it's such a personal thing, isn't it? And it can kind of be interpreted in many different ways. And I suppose I interpret it in two different ways, in that it can be being, you know, steering your own ship and always presenting as authentic, which can be not a sort of fixed thing for a lot of people, and it can be quite difficult to do in all scenarios. But it can also mean a wider thing of being an ally for others and being present for others. And it's something I think that's really underestimated, being present, because you can show up in your past all the time and you can show up in your future all the time in that state of anxiety. But showing up in your present tense is selfish and selfless. You know, it's for everybody. And it's sort of, I suppose, my ongoing goal. And again, it's never a fixed thing for me.
I think that's such a brilliant way of summing it up. And I also love that piece around kind of allyship, because I think, you know, showing up is as much as it is about showing up for yourself and being honest and true to who you are, but it is about creating space and an opportunity for others. And, you know, you've done that with your charity, your kind of various different kind of philanthropic work. Have you always sort of showed up in that way, or has that been something that you've kind of got with age and time? Has that been something that's just been quite organic and natural to you?
I think, if I'm honest, I haven't always. And I think it's only becoming a minority that made me become like that. And I think you're right about, in showing up, what you do is create space. You don't occupy space, because when you show up as a minority, you encourage others to, and you normalize things that are taboo, that people are fearful of. So I think it's only for me, living as a burn survivor, that forced me to live in that way. And I suppose it was taken away. Like, choice can be a luxury, you know. And for me, like, I have a facial disfigurement, so there's no day off, you know. So unfortunately, I show up when I don't want to, you know, all the time, everywhere I go. And sometimes that's good for you, because it puts you in uncomfortable situations. And without sort of talking in cliches, like we've all seen in the last 18 months, when you're uncomfortable, it is actually an unwelcomed catalyst for change. And it does take a big trauma collectively and alone to take big leaps forward, because people procrastinate otherwise. And I think we've seen that just in like the UK. Like, it's only when you're sort of pushed to do those things that you actually take, I think, because it's lack of self-belief and lack of faith. But yeah, that's only really happened to me in my sort of 20s and onwards. And I think prior to that, I lived a very sort of normal, selfish life for a young teenager and early 20s something. So, and also, again, going back to that choice of what I now was, I couldn't see anywhere else. So I thought, well, I'll have to sort of like do it and be it. And then hopefully it will become more broad spread.
So one of the things I love about you is your podcast, which I know recently won Best Podcast at the Visionary Honours Awards, which is, for those that don't know, it's an awards that celebrates social impact through popular culture. I want to ask you what the sort of main driving force behind doing the pod was. It's called Extraordinary People. You are an extraordinary person, but I've listened to podcasts where you've been a bit sort of cringed about the labels that others put on you: trailblazer, superwoman, even resilient. Some of those labels that others put on you, I've heard you kind of and maybe it's sort of partly being British, but you seem to be slightly uncomfortable with them. Why is that, do you think?
Because I think obviously it comes from a good place, but I think it can be patronising and condescending. And I see it a lot with people who are living with unwelcomed disease, terminal illness, and they're called brave and inspiring. And you think, well, somebody that gets diagnosed with cancer doesn't choose to be brave. There is no option. Mm. They are just trying to live day in, yeah, and day out. And you know, like I don't really identify with those labels, because I do believe that within each and every one of us is the human spirit, right? And the human spirit can be battered, it can be broken, but it can never be removed. And I think what happens is we sail through life, and until things happen, like major things like divorce, addiction, some kind of trauma, we're not forced to call on that, because we don't, you know, we're not desperate. And it's kind of a shame that it takes us to get to that point of desperation to be like that. And I think what happened with me was so unusual. And I shared my story in documentaries, in books. I was very vocal. And I think when you're vulnerable publicly, people feel like they know you because they relate to you emotionally. So I became like a hairdresser. Everywhere I would go, people would come up to me and tell me the most private stories. You know, I'd be in a restaurant, I'd be queuing in McDonald's, whatever it was. And people would tell me these horrific stories of abuse. And I was like, God, it is like being someone's hairdresser where they're confined in you. And there was two groups of people. There were the ones that had faced adversity and overcome it, not of a fluffy ending, but with practical advice. And there were others that were in a dark place that couldn't see a way out. And I thought, if I marry these two people together on a platform like a pod, hopefully people will stop asking me for the answers to everything, because actually I'm not this inspiring person that knows the answers to everything. I just know how I got through my own life, and that was even very muddled. And that word extraordinary, you know, when you dissect that word extraordinary, it kind of says to you, whatever your background or disability or difference, at this core, at this human spirit, we're all very ordinary. Okay, some people are extraordinary because they've had extra limitations put on them. They've had disadvantages. They haven't had the same start as everybody else. But at the core, we are all the same. And all this hate that's being stirred up in the world at the moment, and all this fear being put around different groups of people, it's a load of shit. Like, we are all the same. We are one human race. And you know, I think we really need to be able to kind of remove that and take that away. And it's what stops people relating to other people and seeing them as the same as them and as human. And it's like that difference we've seen with Ukraine, how people can see themselves in those asylum seekers, but they can't in Afghanistan. And they feel so different. And they're not. Like, I'm a mum, they're a mum. And it's like, it's a really difficult thing. Like, a lot of people can't see themselves within me. And one of the biggest minorities that get in touch with me, which might surprise you, is the trans community. And particularly in the beginning, when I was badly burned and my face was very disfigured. And it was relating to feeling like somebody or born like somebody, but the exterior doesn't match it. And trying to communicate something with the world, but they won't accept you and they won't relate to you. And until they started writing to me and talking like that, I didn't relate to people who were transitioning at all. But now I totally understand it and see it's just a thing we're conditioned to be repelled by or to fear, but we don't need to.
You must deal with, and I've listened to several of the podcasts, some really heavy hitting stuff. Like, you invite people on, you create a safe space, you are this listening ear, and they unload, and you hope that the end result of that is people listening at home are inspired or they are encouraged to get help in whatever they want to. But how do you leave that at home? How can you unplug your microphone and make yourself a cup of tea and go and put your daughters to bed? Does it stay with you? How do you sort of reconcile that?
Yeah, it is hard. And you have to sort of recognize your triggers and you have to sort out your coping mechanisms. But sometimes there's certain things, like for me, like violence, like when I hear of stories of violence, I do find it really hard to just comprehend how as humans we do this to each other. And it's so evil and it's so destructive. But yeah, I think for me, I don't really drink much. I don't drink alcohol a lot. I do find alcohol like quite toxic. I find it a depressant. You know, it doesn't bring out the best in me. So I have to be mindful of that. And I have to do stuff. Like, I do have to exercise a lot to, like, I'm a big believer in energies. And if I feel like negative and dark energy, I have to physically let that leave my body. So I might go running, I might do weightlifting. But it's about sort of having your own boundaries too, and being able to sort of not take on everyone's stuff and not try to be solution led, not try to fix people, like just listen to them and let them tell their story. And that's how you can sort of keep that boundary, because they're not offloading to you for an answer, because there sometimes isn't an answer. And I think also then in terms of my fulfillment, like a lot of the other stuff I do, say with my charity, it's not government funded, it's all through the general public. So when you look at it like that, you can come to the conclusion that like 99% of the population are pretty decent people. And actually, when you hear these small stories, they are so rare. That's why they make it onto platforms, because it's not really regular behavior by a normal person, you know? And I think holding on to that perspective really normalizes it for me.
Yeah, I think that is a really great way of looking at it. And I'm fascinated to know, because you've got such a sort of variety of stories and variety of guests, from sort of well-known names to then people, you know, who've just got extraordinary stories and have survived extraordinary things. How do you choose? Because I imagine you must be absolutely inundated, and like you want to be a safe space for all of these stories, but what's kind of the process there?
That's really hard, because you get really good quality stories, really good people. You get some really rubbish people as well. Like, oh, I've suffered from migraines for years. I'd love to come and talk about it. And you're like, oh, wow. I'm not sure. No offense to the migraine community. And it's hard to choose, and you need to choose things that people is going to resonate with other people. And also because it is quite exhausting, as you'll know, you know, you do give a lot when you're the host. So you've got to sort of protect that energy. I recorded this morning in person with my friend. She's called Lucy Edwards. She's quite big on TikTok and YouTube. She's a broadcaster and she's fully blind. And
she's a
Pantene ambassador.
Yes, she's amazing.
That's how we've become friends through, we both work with Pantene. And she came in this morning to the studio, and she lost her eyesight in one eye at 11 and then in the other eye at 17. So she fully remembers what it was like to be fully sighted. So it's really, I mean, for me, I live with no eyesight in my left eye and 75% in my right eye. So we did kind of bond over banging into things and stuff like that. I was blind in the beginning, only for a few days in hospital, but you know, it is really weird waking up and opening your eyes to darkness. And I think just talking to her this morning, it just sort of reminded me of course, there's always going to be someone out there with a problem bigger than yours, but just putting all those things into context for you and how you never stop learning and you never stop coming across lessons in life of why you should have gratitude. And I do think no matter how successful or in your eyes happy you become, I think that's really important and really quite enriching, you know. And like today is a weird day for me, because it's actually the anniversary of my attack today. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't really think about it much anymore. And it was funny, I was going on my way to meet Lucy and I thought, what an appropriate person to spend the morning with and to listen to and learn from, and not to make the day about my life or my events and like how much I can take from Lucy and what she's doing. Like, she's changing like the commercial space, like with Pantene, she's putting QR codes on things. People are shopping with QR codes and no eyesight. Like, it's so inspiring. And I was like, let me dwell on that today and nothing else, you know?
Yeah. And that is an extraordinary story. And I think we see through your kind of the journaling and the writing and the affirmations, that sentiment of gratitude, I think that's so important. We could all be so much more grateful and engaged with what we have. And we live in this society where it's never enough. Are you still on that journey? So obviously, you know, you're a big voice for gratitude and all of those things. But do you sometimes feel like you have to check yourself as well?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of like have a love-hate relationship with this whole, like, gratitude is really important, but this like body positivity movement, because sometimes I feel like it's just another way to beat women up for not feeling a certain way.
Yeah.
And all this language about, I love what I see when I look in the mirror, I love myself naked, look at this. And I think, well, I don't feel like that all the time. So am I not confident then? You know, am I a failure as an advocate? And like for me, I would strive to feel neutral. You know, that would be successful for me, to feel neutral and indifferent and to feel like I've got lots of other things to bring to the table too, but to sometimes feel sexy and attractive also, you know. Like I definitely wouldn't be able to post in front of the mirror dancing naked on my Instagram because I don't, it's not authentic.
It would be, by the way, don't worry.
I'd be mortified, like mortified, you know, and I wouldn't want to be paparazzi on the beach in a bikini, and I am a size 8, but that's just how I feel, like, you know. And so I don't want to be that person that says positivity is key, acceptance, always feeling confident, be a good role model, because that's really nice in the online space, right? But that's not practical. I wouldn't give my daughter that advice. It's not true. It's not authentic. No. It's not, if you're single, it's not the dating world. It's not true, you know?
I think a really underrated word is content.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're saying, isn't it? Around, we are bombarded, whether you choose to consume or you're just sort of indirectly consuming, we are bombarded by those kind of messages as a particularly as a woman and as a man too. But we're completely battling with fake confidence over real confidence and just trying to find this neutral space. I think that's a really, really healthy way to look at it. And I'm interested in, you mentioned Pantene, which is obviously a huge sort of beauty brand. We've done some work before with our client Amanda Decadenay and Dove and Getty a number of years ago, and Girl Gaze, all around trying to challenge beauty norms and, you know, trying to give a wider library of images for brands, not just beauty brands, but any brand to kind of to choose from that represents everyone, like, you know, everyone or as many of us as you can. How did you feel when you got that sort of nod of recognition from a brand like Pantene? Was it a real sort of pinch me moment?
Yeah, it was quite a excruciating process. because it was before COVID. I've been with them about 3 or 4 years now. And so video call wasn't a big thing. And they wanted, like for me, normally how partnerships come about is they go to my agent cuts a deal, we talk, and then I meet the client on the basis that we are going to work together, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And that's how, that's
not an audition.
Yeah, but with this, it was like they expressed an interest, and then it was almost like an interview on video call, which, you know, I didn't even have, Zoom didn't exist or anything. I had to download this complicated platform, and they wanted to talk to me about my hair story. And I knew I wasn't the only person being considered. I knew there was other talent being considered. So it felt like a competitive audition, if I'm honest. And I thought, oh shit, I know what hair models look like. I know what hair commercials look like. And it's definitely not me. And I do have a hair story where I had really bad hair at a certain point and I had my head shaved. And I was just like, I don't really know what to say to get me the job. So I just thought it's going to be good practice. I probably won't get the job, but it'll be good. And you know, you don't usually get feedback, but I thought hopefully I'd get feedback to help me in the future or something. So I sort of talked about my journey. And then I couldn't tell how it went. And then it was a few days until I heard that I'd got the job. And I was like really surprised. And I thought, I wonder in what capacity, maybe it would be like make some content or something. I didn't really understand the partnership and like all their plans and stuff. And then when I really finally understood it and we shot and we did the ad, I thought, oh, I'll be bleached out, like with bright white light, because that, you know, scars are very much texture and more like when you're animated, like when you meet someone in person, you can sort of see skin graft more. So I thought I'll probably be like bleached out, I'll probably be smoothed out, and it'll be very much about my hair and being like a woman's woman type thing, empowerment and stuff. And then it was really like high definition, like showing everything of me, but not in a sort of charitable, pitiful way. It was still glamorous, high-end clothes, you know, really nicely shot. And it was actually like a little bit of a relief for me, like in the sense of a bit like when you're chatting to a guy online and you finally go for a drink in person. And it was like, oh, like everyone's seen me now doing this thing at this level, but it is actually what I look like, you know? And I was like, thank God. And I'm being paid and it's good money and it's not like a pity project. And I don't know, it was like a really nice relief. And then every year I assumed they wouldn't renew me. I'd live in anxiety every year. They won't renew me. They won't renew me. They'll get someone else now who's not burnt, or they'll get a different disability or something that represents diversity in a different way. And every year I've lived like that, which sounds so dreadful. And I think now they signed up Lucy as well, I'm starting to see actually this is real, this is a pledge.
It's a long-term commitment, yeah. Not a box tick, which so many brands are guilty of because they don't really know how to show up. So they make sort of clumsy mistakes. Yeah. But it's interesting you talking about, you know, I told myself I wouldn't get it, but I'd learn from it. And second time around, you know, even though I know I've done a good job, I probably won't get it. That's sort of, it's
so, imposter syndrome,
it's kind of at odds though with the affirmation, Katie, of this, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to start the day positively and I'm going to write little affirmations for my kids that they might sort of understand. It's really at odds with the other side of you. So are you sort of, do you flip between imposter syndrome and, you know, this kind of self-belief? Do you flip between the two?
I think I'm guilty of working really hard for something and never fully arriving, because when I get it, that goes back to that fear of losing it. And like,
yes.
Really, you should be like, I've got it. I should bask in it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So I think it's like a bit of a heightened state of anxiety. But in my everyday life, like, I'm a very like disciplined, optimistic, like highly resilient person, especially in everyday interactions. I'm able to cope really well. I'm everybody's go-to. I'm like the head of the house, but, you know, which is quite draining. Yeah. But yeah, I think I do definitely get self-doubt in competitive fields, because the competitive space I'm in was never built for someone like me. So I think, and I'm not surrounded by colleagues really.
Yeah. Do you think as well, maybe, because there are so many things that you do, you've got so many sort of strings to your bow in the most incredible way. And it's part of that, maybe even subconsciously, like future-proofing. You're like, I'm here, I've got this. If that goes, I've got this. I think we're a bit like that as well, actually.
Yeah, it's hard with the juggle. I mean, I love being busy, but I'm telling myself I love being busy, but I actually do love being busy. But I know when to stop, and I do now take myself off for a walk or a massage or whatever. You are somebody that, and we only see what we see that you share with us, but you seem to be constantly on the go. Are you somebody, for example, that, you know, when it gets to 6 o'clock, phone's off, it's all about the kids, it's bath time, it's that sort of, it's their time and routine? Or, you know, as soon as they're in bed, are you kind of back on emails? How do you balance, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a business point of view, I've always believed in multiple income streams, multiple revenues, you know, freelance. I've never believed in saying, right, I'm going to be a TV presenter and that's all I'm going to nurture and that's all I'm going to put my energies into, because I think that's like a very fragile industry. And actually, even before I was in the public eye, like all my life, I've very rarely had an employer. I've always been self-employed, and I've always learned trades and different vocations where I can have evening work, weekend work, you know, and go beyond your sort of classic sort of 40 hours a week or whatever. So that's never changed about me. But I think what happened to me gave me a bit of like financial anxiety and unease, in that I suddenly was met with, even though my acute care was on the NHS, I was met with a lot of medical bills that will never end, you know. And if I told you what I spend on private medical care for my eyesight, for my esophagus, and all the unplanned operations that come up each year that I not only have to fund, but have to take off work unpaid.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it gave me a little bit of like financial anxiety of like, you know, you don't know what the future holds. And I've had things in my legal case change where I've had to get a barrister like the next day. And then the legal case has gone on for like 8 months and stuff. So I've always sort of learned it's only me to rely on and to do that. So I think that drives me and makes me work harder. But like you, I do enjoy, you know, like I love my job. I enjoy being ambitious. I enjoy achievement. But actually, I am quite a quiet person. Like, I'm not very sociable. I moved away from London recently, so I don't really go out late at night or anything like that. So when I'm not sort of visible at work and stuff, I'm very much sort of like at home, no makeup, tracksuit. I try to protect weekends, so I don't really work weekends. And my children have got quite a lot of like competitive sports and hobbies they do. So I'm very involved. I do like chaperoning at those, and they go to
you're a weekend taxi driver,
yeah. Which is still kind of being busy, but it's relaxing, yeah, for me,
because
it's not about me, it's about them. So and I enjoy that. So yeah.
I listened to an interview where, and I love that you said this, because I think it's a really important message, and I think our listeners will really relate. but you said, I don't carry guilt in relation to parenting. And I think that was kind of a nod to navigating your, you know, your busy career, but also knowing if I'm away for work, that's because I've got to do what I've got to do. And actually, when I'm there and I'm present, when I'm back with my kids, have you always had that? Or has that been something that you've kind of evolved as you've gone through your parenting journey?
I've become more vocal and confident to say it, but I've always felt it. And the trouble is, there's so much misogyny around childcare and being a mother and having a job and what that people think that should look like. So I suppose I've been scared to say it in the past. But yeah, I mean, I had my first child at 30 and then my second at sort of, I think about 34, which is kind of old, some people would say, to have a child. And, you know, I've tried to maintain all the things I love and love them too. And, you know, of course you change when you're a mother, but I wouldn't want to sort of teach my children that there's only one way. And they may not be like me. They may not choose the path that I did. And I'm fine for that. I just try not to cast any judgment on anyone, because my mum chose to give up her career and be a homemaker. And she was a brilliant mum. And I'm so glad she did. But I chose a very different path to my mum, which maybe at first she didn't understand either, because it was different for her generation. But now she fully supports everything I do. So yeah, I think it's individual, really.
It's really interesting too, because I'd read about your desire to be really transparent with your kids around finances and teach them financial independence. I think as women, we really need that. And we have an obligation, I think, as parents to teach our kids about that. And we've had some people on this podcast talking about how important it is to set budgets for teenagers and be really strict and let them miss something when they've mismanaged. Your kids are a little bit younger than that though. So what are you doing on a sort of practical level to, or maybe not doing anything yet, but what will you do to sort of prepare them for their own sort of financial independence?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's because I'm trying to model it on aspects of how we were raised. So I don't come from a wealthy family, and we had to work as soon as we got our NI number. I mean, we wanted to. It was quite exciting as well. And I always worked at Tesco. We had, I lived in a village, and I remember when we got a 24-hour Tesco, we were like, oh, 24 hours, oh my yeah. God. And, like, we'd meet outside Tesco on dates with like cider and ciggies. And, like, it was the place yeah. where everyone hung out.
We'd go to
the
cafe.
Like, yeah, it was the social hub. And then I got a job there like evenings and weekends when I was at college. And then I worked out, if you worked Sundays, it was double pay back then, and bank holidays were double pay. And I was like, oh, I can extend my pay packet. This is so great. I get 10% off staff discount. And I became like quite excited about that being within your power and being in the driving seat of that. So my children are kind of growing up very differently, really, because, you know, I went to state school. They're going to private school. And like with my job, we get a lot of gifting sent of like clothes, toys, products. And in the end, I have to hide the gifting, because otherwise they're just getting presents on a Monday, and then they're getting like double presents on a Friday because I've gone to the PO box address. And then my daughter's like, there's no toys this week. And I'm like, no, that's not normal. You know, that's, and then you're losing ways to reward them and exercise discipline. It's, you know, it's becoming like they're becoming spoiled through my work without me even actively sort of seeking it. You know, even things like going on holiday, she's like, I mean, it's embarrassing to admit, like walking on the plane, she's like, there's no beds. Where's the bed? And I'm just like, oh my God, hun, this is Ryanair to Barcelona. You need to calm down. And sort of realizing, okay, actually, we, even though they are very young, we need to totally take a step back here and try to sort of replicate some of the ways in that I grew up. So yeah, it's hard. I don't have the right answers for it. And I really try to protect my children and help them lead as normal life as possible. But that means different things to different people.
Yeah. I feel like it's a bit of a universal theme, because we had another guest on the pod who said exactly the same thing about the reason why she had so much hustle was because of her kind of humble beginnings. And, you know, so I guess it is a difficult thing when you are living a slightly more privileged life to then instill that grit, really.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I suppose the only advantage I have is I'm able to instill in them that everything can change in a minute, and things that feel so secure and feel yours, feel your birthright, can be taken away from you. but you can rebuild, but only you can, like no one else will do it for you. And, you know, we're able to have those kind of sort of open conversations. And that's why I've got them quite heavily into sport, because I do think sport is really good for accountability and personal responsibility and only you getting you over that finish line, you know, so yeah.
Tell us a bit about the Katie Piper Foundation. So that is something that you set up. I read somewhere or listened somewhere where you said, somebody asked you how many operations you had and you said, I stopped counting at 300.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just like everybody process that for a second. And you talk about the end of the NHS acute care journey and then being left, you know, to pay lots of bills and to navigate going back into the workplace and relationships and all the rest of it. And you had to go abroad, didn't you, to get that care. You had to go to France, I think. And then donations kept coming in and you brick by brick created this place in Liverpool where people in the UK can access without having to travel abroad. That is, you know, maybe it's 13 or 14 years old now. Mm. How do you keep that funded? That's not, you know, government funded. When you're navigating and, you know, prioritizing your own family and your own income, how do you find time to constantly fundraise for that?
It's really hard. And in a way, it's a constant noose around your neck, because like with having the actual building, you have inpatients, you know, you have patients that are going through what might have started out as 6 weeks of treatment that has actually escalated to 3 months of treatment. Average burn patient, 6 weeks of treatment is over 20 to 30 grand, depending on like the complexity. And also they could be having treatment, then grafts split, they get infections, like there could be unforeseen things. And also the psychological, you know, they might not be able to cope with the physical treatment because of mental health stuff or addictions they may have developed in the recovery. So it's really, really hard. And in the beginning of the charity, the funding was more straightforward because it was people were emotionally moved by my story and they sort of donated on that empathy. But it got a lot harder as the charity went on. And also we attracted more cases that needed our help as we formalized and as we had a bigger board. And then before COVID, majority of our funding would be grants and trusts, individual givers, high net worth individuals, and then on the ground fundraisers, general public and events. So when COVID hit, we lost a quarter of our income because the way people were giving dried up. You know, whatever your financial situation was, you were putting stuff on hold because you didn't know what the future was. Events went out the window. Sometimes we are able to fund patients through insurance cases. So like when people are burnt at work or burnt in accidents, their insurers will fund their rehab, which is also a good pathway to sort of help people immediately. I'm a donor to the charity myself and I'm a volunteer as well. But yeah, it's very, very difficult. But I do thrive in a crisis and I am attracted to it. And I do like a challenge like that. So, you know, it doesn't put me off doing it. And we always find new creative ways to get there and we manage it. And I suppose it's the passion of knowing we need it, because when I went abroad for treatment, it was only because I had a social worker and a psychologist attached to my case. And they told me there's this treatment that you have to apply for through the primary care trust and you can get specialist funding. Well, I wouldn't have even have known how to access and apply for that if they hadn't told me, which seemed very unfair. You know, like in the medical world, there's a real postcode lottery and it's really unfair. And I didn't get the full funding for the full amount. I only had like part funded, part treatment. So when my story went on these big platforms and people like Simon Cowell came forward to want to help me, and just members of the public were putting like checks, like, do you remember checks? That sounds so old. Checks for like a tenner. And they were putting them through my mum and dad's door and stuff because we lived in a small village and people recognised the house and the documentary. And my mum and dad were like confiscating every check. And they were like, you've had all your treatment in the NHS. You can't take this money. I'm like, guys, I'm on disability benefit. Give me the money. And then we put it or in like charitable status bank account, and we were like, let's just make lump sums of money where if big burn cases happen in the news, we could just give them like 5 grand, 10 grand, and they can just go to the same place I went to. But then as the help never stopped and we were able to formalize the board with sort of doctors, surgeons, lawyers, we said, actually, look, people going abroad when they're already isolated and don't speak the language, they actually need to be with their support network here. It needs to be here. So that was the big drive for the charity. But then there was a separate social change of I was really alone and isolated, and I was trying to find like-minded people. And all you can find online back then, which was 15 years ago, no such thing as diversity in like the media, disability representation. All you'll find is military heroes, young male men that have been to Iraq, Kosovo, Afghanistan, or a lot of American burn survivors. There was a lot of communities in America, and they were forums where your username would be your percent burns. So you'd be like, Katie, 98% burns. And then it was just people saying they were worse off than you and arguing about whose life was more shit. So I was just like, I need to, yeah. And also it was like other charities as well, the image. I was like, well, I still like fashion. I still want to have sex. I still want to have a boyfriend. I still want to have a career, not just a job. And other charities didn't reflect that image and it wasn't there. And I was just like, why is society telling me it's over for me? I'm 24. It can't be over for me. I've fighted so much to be here. If it's over for me, I might as well have not gone through all that treatment.
Yeah.
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 And is that when you're on those forums trying to find solace and trying to find peers that you could talk to and share your experience and it felt a bit toxic, is that when you found faith? Because you weren't brought up religious, were you? That was something that you found, I'm guessing, as a way of, as a coping mechanism. How did that come into your life?
Yeah, it was quite early on in my own recovery. I was an inpatient for 3 months in London, and it was had like the same staff that would look after me, and one of them was religious. So, and I was always on my own, and she would always come and just sit with me because I didn't sleep and stuff for a while. So she would just sit with me through the nights, and she would kind of say prayers and sing. And, you know, honestly, I at the time was like, this is quite annoying, but I don't have any other friends and I have nothing else to do and I'm not going anywhere fast. And then after a while, I started properly listening and letting it in and not being dismissive and judgmental. And it was a real source of comfort. And then I stayed in touch with her and sort of carried on that friendship with that nurse. And then it just was something that I physically felt and I related to, and it had a big place in my life. And I'm the only one in my family still. You know, my mum laughs at me and is like, what do you think about Darwin's theory then, if you believe in this? How do you explain this? How do you explain Mary and Joseph? And we have like a bit of a laugh about it. But like, I'm like 100% there with the God squad. And she's like, no, absolutely not.
I really relate. I think for me, faith, it feels like it's all the same thing, even though you might have different religions, different practices. It's ultimately rooted in that sort of hope for better in terms of yourself, how you show up, hope for better in terms of how the world around you shows up. But I think it's ultimately underpinned by hope and kindness and empathy.
And also saying something is bigger than us. Like, yeah, you know, yeah. And that's you're never big, like the problem's never bigger than you, but you're never the biggest thing here. And actually, if you can believe in that, whatever that looks like for you, however you label it, you can actually slightly surrender and take comfort in that, you know, you're not in control in a good way.
I love that sentiment. And actually Fern had said something that really resonated when she said she was doing a podcast and she said, in 200 years, none of us are going to be here. And weirdly, that just kind of really just spoke to the fact that like none of us, nothing that's going on, is all bigger than us. Everything that we're going through on a day to day, actually, like, just find ways through, because ultimately, it's, you know.
Don't you think that was a good thing in lockdown, though? People were like, actually, like, nothing matters anymore. Nothing's bigger than it. And like, the world's, you know, normally you're like, I've got to get to my meeting. I've got to do it. Oh, my top's not arrived. And
it was a great leveler. I mean, I'm a big fan of the reframe. That's my version of affirmations, I guess, is I went to a place called Body Camp, which was transformative for me. It solidified the decision to get divorced the first time. And one of the guys there, who actually found really annoying, sorry, Rick, if you're listening, because he's like, he's a real like, come on, it's Northern PT. And I was so out of shape.
I love that type of person.
But now I literally, he's one of my favorite
people. We're going to go and see him again
We are going to go see him. It's addictive. But it's interesting. He had a reframing way of everything. Every moan I made, every negative thought I had, he would be able to really, really quickly find a reframe for it. And I think that is what gets me through the day. I've reframed exercise as I used to think of it as torture. And now, like you, it's a vital part of my mental health. So we do this thing on the podcast, which we actually stole the idea from somebody else, which is to ask the community, and we've got a couple of questions, if that's okay, to finish with. Mm-hmm. So one listener would like to know, in one of your books, you talk about rebuilding your life from Z to A, and she would like to know what letter you're on now.
Oh, that's a good question.
Which I think is a great question.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? The letters go backwards and forwards every day. And that Z to A was kind of like, if you ever feel, you know, you mentioned divorce there. And I think if you ever feel something ending, which can be medical, it can be personal, it can be professional, you do sort of think, right, it is Z to A. You're sort of working backwards and you're finding yourself again and you're rebuilding yourself again. And, you know, going back to what you said about reframing things or using affirmations, like how I look at what happened to me is I was given the gift of a miracle, like the obvious gift of a miracle in not dying through what happened to me. But I was given the gift of a miracle of being able to sort of go into the future and feel regret and feel like, oh my God, I think my life's going to end at 24. I wish I'd done this. I wish I'd mended those bridges. I wish I'd been more forward and assertive. I wish I hadn't have seeked that fulfillment. And I was given the gift of going into the future, regretting all these things and being allowed to come back and live differently. And that's what I've done. I've come back from A to Z a couple of times and I'm living differently now. And that's like, if you read those books about biggest regrets on your deathbed, that's like end of life perspective, you know? So to get that perspective at 24. So I think in terms of what letter I'm living at, I'm always living around the middle of the alphabet and going a few that way and a few that way each day. And I think that is what life is. And I know we always think life is linear, but I think anyone with any sort of life experience will know it's a bit more like the tube map, you know?
Yeah, no, it certainly is. Okay, so we've got another question, which is very interesting, actually. So you shared that you stopped exercising for a week as part of a study to see what effect or no movement has on your mental health. How did you find that and what were some of the effects?
I was bloated, miserable and tired. Yeah. I mean, God, it was awful. I love exercise, but of course I'm human. So I still get that, oh God, I've booked in a PT session. Oh God, I've arranged to run with my friend. And actually accountability helps me. So if it is arranging to run with friends or if it is paying for a session up front, that forces me. The moment I'm in it, I'm loving life. But of course I suffer from that like getting started thing, but it's just going past that. And I think anything that requires discipline in your life, everyone has that moment where it'd be easier not to, you know? So yeah, it was hard. It affected me physically, it affected me mentally. And to be as busy and on the go as I am, exercise has to be part of my life 3 to 4 times a week. Otherwise I couldn't physically show up and do what I do. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we end the episode by asking everybody, all of our guests, to share what tiny little things, what everyday free things we can do to show up in culture, just to help make the world a better place, because we feel mm-hmm. that it's all of our job. So it's irrespective of what size platform you've got or what your financial status is. It's almost like what you can do as just Joe Blogs to show up in your own way. What sort of things and tips would you like to share with the listeners?
I always think when you're given tips when you're younger at school and stuff, it's around academia and that will be your way to get opportunity in the world. But I think as an adult, we all know the truth is it's your network and who you know. And I think wherever possible, you should create and share opportunity with other people, because there's really talented people out there that can't get their foot in the right doors. And there's no amount of hard work that will change that, you know? So I do think it is important to whatever you need in life to prosper. If you can give that and share that, just do that. And what will happen then is when that person becomes successful, they'll remember you and they'll include you too. So you'll gain back. It will be like a complete sort of circle, you know? So I think that's really important. If you never stop giving, you'll never stop receiving. But be assertive enough to recognize when you stop receiving. And know when to be like, yeah. Okay, right, like I need to.
I've had a moment where I've stopped receiving and yeah. I was like, oh, I'm giving. giving way too much for this.
And that does, when you start looking, that becomes obvious after a while. If you start looking
really
for it, you really start to. So that's okay to be able to do that as well. And especially as a female, don't associate that with you being nasty or unkind, because you know this word, like selfless. She's a selfless woman. It's not good to be a selfless woman. It means you're a doormat letting everyone walk all over you. But it's like, we don't talk about men being selfless. We don't even attach that word to a man. So yeah, just be careful not to feel like you have to fall under those sort of like feminine labels to be a nice person. To be that's being unkind to yourself, I think.
Yeah, great advice. Katie, thank you so much. Thank you for being kind and generous. This is, you know, our first podcast of someone that we don't know. And actually, we were really nervous.
Oh, we were really nervous. And it's everything, actually, we hoped it would be, and more. It's been great. And actually, now we are best friends.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I really enjoyed it.
We're coming now. That was one of the most transformative conversations I've ever had with anyone.
Yeah.
Period.
I have long admired Katie. I've been at events where she's been and I've almost gone over and gone, I think you're brilliant. And you never really know. And obviously working with talent, they don't always want that. And you're meant to be in a safe space when you're at events. So I never have gone over, but I was so grateful to her for agreeing to come on the podcast and you know, doing all the research that we did because we don't know her, you know, I'm even more astounded and enamored by her. And I loved what she was sort of saying around sharing opportunities, you know, and that being how everybody can show up in culture is just like, don't be selfish. If you've got network opportunities, thoughts, ideas, share those with your peers and your friends, because that's going to open doors. Because I do think she's right. And it's, you know, no one ever says that. Everybody always says, you know, do better at school or like get your head down. And I'm saying that to my 16-year-old in his GCSE prep at the moment. But, you know, we all know that actually those qualities of being nice and fair and kind and sharing are going to, A, sort of shape who you are as a person, but also get you ahead in life. And that thing she said about if you never stop giving, you'll never stop receiving.
I think that's beautiful. It's big. And I also, for me, just the gratitude, you know, that sort of sense of being able to go, this is bigger than all of us. And yes, I've experienced trauma. And yes, I've had a tough time. But actually, I'm going to just keep plowing forward. And I'm grateful. And I think we, as people, as individuals, as collectives, we can often forget, like, just to be grateful for the small stuff. Like, to just be like, I'm grateful that I could open up my eyes today and see. Just the stuff we take for granted. We just take so much for granted.
Well, you know this, but my phrase or my motto in life is there is only now. So yesterday's gone and tomorrow's not here yet. There's only now. And, you know, I don't read affirmations, but that is a bit of a mantra because it really helps to level.
That's a leveler, isn't it?
And it really helps to get you to that point of contentment of going, there is only now. And if me drinking an actual hot cup of tea in one go before the school run is like a little win, find your little thing that's like a little win in the day. And I think her sort of talking about that neutrality and, you know, just being sort of happy with your lot. I mean, I just think it's a really important conversation to have, to share, to listen to. So we really hope that you loved it as much as we loved talking to Katie. We're going to put in the show notes all of the brilliant work that she does around her foundation, all of the sort of broadcast work and her books. There is genuinely something for everyone in there. And thank you for listening. And, you know, we'd also love to know who else you might want us to chat to, because now we've got to the end of our mates. We've got another guest coming up next week who is a new friend, new best friend. We're really, really excited. We'll tease that in the week. But yeah, just like get in touch and let us know who out there you think is contributing positively to culture and who you want to have a chat with, and we'll try and make it happen. And we'll get some men on soon as well.
Well, thank you for showing up with us, and more soon.
Bye-bye.